Hi, everybody. I'll clear my throat.
And can I just check, can you hear Brahm all right?
Can you hear me? Good, 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 good.
Brahm, can you just bring the microphone just a little bit closer to you?
To me, okay.
Along with the one up.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Okay, I don't want to pull it all over.
Okay. Also being able to see your screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm fine. Yeah, okay.
Lovely. Thanks. Shall
I start then? Okay, good. Well, good morning, everybody. And I really liked the last two talks. I'm going to talk about something sort of somewhat more, pedantic, statistical, but I'm going to end with something more philosophical. I want to talk about the monitoring, the placement of pupils with special educational needs in English special schools. And this is sort of based on the CSIE, and I need to go very quickly because I'm 15 minutes, and I'm going to focus on past issues, which I'll go through very quickly, and on some future prospects. Now, CSIE, as you all know, have done these trend publications, and this is the latest one. It was published 2019. This is just a screenshot to show the local authorities over the last 4 years and the proportions of pupils within the 0 to 25 range, and you can see that Newham are top of having the least proportion in special schools and so on. So I don't want to speak too much. Including in the last one, for the first time, we had an interactive website, and this is showing Bristol City. I thought, as we're in, this is Bristol City, and I don't want it too long, and you can point. Go through the website and so on and so forth. So this, I think, is the key message that has come out of all the years of monitoring. And what it shows is, starting in 1982, for all special schools in England, the steady decline. And the blue line represents, if you can see, the age range where the denominator is 5 to 15. And then in the later, the proportions fall, so you can't have a direct, but then it became 0 to 19 as the range. So you can see the latest one. The most important thing, in my view, of this diagram is that the increase starts in 2007, does not start with austerity. And I think I'm not going to have time to talk about, but maybe we'll discuss, what are the causes of what we now are seeing, which is the gradual but very steady incline, and the assumption that over the next decade this is going to continue, certainly in the statistical projections. So I don't want to spend too long on that. I want to say a bit about the recommendations that came out in the last report, and these were recommendations in relation to parents, that parents and voluntary organisations can use this data and the web application to find out what they can expect from local authorities, and also expectations from government, because, of course, all this data comes from the pupil database, and that is an enormous operation that government runs, an enormous operation. Now, I think it was the Labour government, when they signed the Convention for Rights, said that they were committed to continuing to develop an inclusive system where parents of disabled children have increasing access to mainstream schools, which have the capacity to meet the needs of disabled. And that, and there's a sort of rider, and I won't go into all of that. But I think it's really interesting, and I wonder whether even the present government would commit itself to that. But certainly the previous government, the coalition government, I have my doubts. Clearly, and this came out in the last report, it calls for a thorough, transparent, values-based and evidence-informed strategy. And the data collection needs to be not just thought about and reviewed at national level, but also at local level and at school level. And I'll say a bit more about that in the next slide, the one after this. One of the other things that was recommended, and I still think is applicable, is that we need time-based data as well, particularly because we have hybrid placements and provision. So if a child is as a dual placement or there's a co-located school, we need to know about the time-based. And this is done in the United States at the federal level, though maybe with the new administration, no more Department of Education, that will stop. I think we need to know more about proportions and how special class units, resource and so on. There is no information on that. And it seems to me that that's one of the areas that review could deal with. Now, I think a bit about the context of this review. It was started by Will Swan in 1982, 83. I'm sure you've got all the data. And it's been done periodically since then, and I sort of took over from Will, and I can't even remember the date. The principle behind this was local authority responsibility, because in those days, local authorities had more power. And, of course, special education provision in the 81 Act, which is still the cornerstone framework of the legislation, very much puts it that it's local authorities that determine special provision. So the idea was that the statistics would use what's called an input-export formula, which is why the latest government data I showed you up to last year doesn't do that. It just looks at the schools in the area. But of course, schools import across boroughs, particularly in big urban areas, and they export. Newham exports children to other local authorities, which is why it does still have special schools. So even its low proportion, it still has children in special schools. So that's a sort of refinement. But of course, this notion that local authorities are responsible seems to me to be threatened by our more diversified system. I know some like to call it fragmented with a strong value judgment, talking about language. I just use the word diversified. Reduced powers for local authority, academization, and some very large academy trusts. And of course, the disability legislation has introduced a whole new frame. And I think one of the areas for statutory review is the incompatibility between SEN and disability legislation assumptions, with potentially more responsibility placed on schools. And of course, one of the features of the current code of practice is the idea of a local offer, which I think is a very interesting one. And they're supposed to both develop and report what is available, and one would expect they would report data. So for this talk, I especially went on to Newham and Portsmouth. Why Newham and Portsmouth? Well, Newham because it has the lowest proportion, and that's the top one, and Portsmouth because I know Portsmouth has some very interesting provision and has some interesting developments. So on. Now, Portsmouth has absolutely no data in its local offer. I mean, they might tell you what special, but they show you none of this refinement. But Newham does. You can see in the bottom right, that's the sort of data they produce, and I won't go through that. I mean, they record there, very interestingly, that even in Newham, the proportion of children, young people with an EHC plan has trebled since 2019, even in Newham, and so on. And I won't go through all. They do actually don't do a time series, but they do show their position as having the least proportion in special schools. So, I mean, well done for Newham. So I'm going to move now to talking about prospects and more interpretation. Clearly, proximity to peers in a mainstream, general, regular school, whatever, this is where language is really important, is a limited indicator of inclusive provision. But one could argue it's an important one. And this is not a language issue. This is a value and conceptual issue. And this is this issue between integration and inclusion. And I think the question that exercises me is, can inclusive provision be available outside general schools and classes? I think that's a very fundamental question. And I think it's interesting to consider the pathways from 2007. And I put down there three schematic pathways. And we are on pathway B. Roughly, we're on pathway B. And of course, one of the questions is, why are we on pathway B and not on pathway C? I'll leave out A for a moment. Why are we not on path on C? Now, that requires some sort of analysis. I've kind of said what I think. which is it's not just austerity by any means. And it'd be interesting to hear what people think about that. A, I think, is very interesting. I remember Mark Vaughan asking me some years ago when we were on the downward track, and he said, well, Brahm, at what point will we have no more special schools? I said, Mark, I don't know. But I did extrapolate, and I sort of took the graph, and I think it was about 2050, at the rate that it was going down, if you remember the blue one. But I think that raises questions about what do we mean by a special school? And that is really a very important point. So I want to introduce a small-scale study I was involved in, which is part of a project that I never got any funding for, which I was very disappointed to. And interesting, it's a project I want to, in some respect, to which this is. I mean, the logic behind this is as follows. If inclusion is about belonging and acceptance, and that's a very current view, then separate specialist settings could be argued to be inclusive. And of course, that raises questions about how we want to define inclusive or inclusion. So the question from a research point of view is, what research on parental perspectives on special schools and inclusive education would say about this? So this is a study, I can send you a copy of one, in the European Journal of Special Needs Education. David Satherley, David did this as part of his doctoral, he's at Psych. The aims of this study were to investigate whether the sort of focus on optimizing choice operates as was intended, but more specifically to examine the views of parents of pupils who have recently gone into special schools, and this was in Southwest England schools, their reasons for choosing special schools, the extent to which they felt they had an independent choice, and their views on alternative provision. Not an area of much research, interestingly. We had 57 parents who completed a questionnaire in three local authorities. There was both numerical and qualitative textual data, and there was in-depth follow-up with a large-ish sample. And I'm not going to talk about that, but none of the individual interviews go against the general findings. The top three reasons, the top three factors that these parents said influenced their decision were school atmosphere, a caring approach to pupils, and class size, of a long list. Factors which were seen as much less important were the standard of education, examination results, and having siblings at the school. And interestingly, and in a way this is the really interesting bit, I think, these perspectives connected with these parents' conceptions of what inclusive education was about. More than 50% considered that high-quality inclusive provision meant a sense of belonging to class and school, social acceptance by peers, and a more individualized curriculum. Over 70% of these parents would select a two. So they went together. Most of these three factors went together. Many of the parents, slightly less than half, also selected the descriptor that quality provision was special school provision only. Now, the parents were also asked to what degree did they think that mainstream...
just a momentary interruption, okay. But beware,
it might carry on. Okay, I'll stop. The question of to what degree mainstream education with support would be appropriate for their children. And just over half of these parents indicated that to some degree they thought that with appropriate support, a mainstream placement would be appropriate. But just under half said no, they did not. And I think that's a very, very important finding. And it fits Runswick-Cole's research, which goes back to 2008, in which she came up with this very interesting typology. And she said there are parents where there is nothing but mainstream schooling. And there are parents where there is nothing but special school. And then there are parents who are committed to mainstream schooling, but they later change their minds. In other words, inflexible ordinary provision. And I think this very much fits and is relevant to what we're going through now with the financial crisis in the special needs funding issue. So I want to finish off now and say a bit about, and this is the more philosophical bit, we have two contrasting concepts of inclusion, and I think people find this very hard to coordinate contrasting concepts. This is really a pluralism-monism issue in philosophical terms. On one hand, we have Mary Warnock's idea of inclusion, that inclusion is really about learning what is personally relevant, wherever it takes place. And it's not necessarily under the same roof. That was her phrase. And she argued this all the way along. And then we have the sort of notion that you get in the inclusion index, which is that inclusion is a more social model. The left-hand side's more personal model. Increased participation, reduced exclusion of students in the culture, curriculum, and communities of local school, and where the onus is on the general school to accommodate diversity for academic and social participation. It seems to me that we need both. A coherent framework would integrate both personal relevance and common shared relevance. And here is a proposal of how we could do this. This is what I would call a two-dimensional model of special needs educational inclusion, which in the vertical axis is the social model, and you have degrees of that, and on the horizontal axis is the personal model. And I'm using, it's used sometimes in policy analysis, it's called the 45-degree coordination type model. It's used in the 45-degree line there represents the coordination of those values. So the more you locate things closer to that line, the more you're trying to meet both values. There is an inevitable trade-off, perhaps, that one has to accept, and that's where the monist philosophical views find it difficult. But I won't go into all that. The point is that it's the right-hand area where you optimize personal relevance and social participation, not in the bottom left, because that's low on both, nor in the top left or the bottom right, the ones represented in red, which are fairly inflexible, not very well adapted, ordinary provision, or special schools that are somewhat isolated, or special units that are somewhat isolated. So in that sort of rose area seems to me to be where prospect of more inclusion in this broader sense of inclusion lies. Adapted and supported ordinary class full time. Not sure that's possible for everyone. Co-located special schools. And then the combination of part-time in units, well-connected with ordinary provision, additionally adapted and supported. So that's the sort of proposal that I would say, is that we really need a broader notion, and some would say a more conservative notion of inclusion. And I would say, well, maybe that's what our democratic citizenship would want. We will see. I've got evidence to show they do want it, but I won't talk about that. So what is the significance of what I'm saying? We clearly need to review the data collection practices nationally, locally, and at school level. I would say time-based data for mixed settings. Clearly all this statistical data is limited. We need more experiential accounts. But we also need reported experience-based measures. There are some very useful measures of belonging and social acceptance and very good research in that area using those metrics. And we need to address this question, can inclusive provision be available outside general ordinary settings? And I think we need, and certainly something like the parent study I've been discussing, and that if inclusion as belonging and acceptance, personalized learning, is then available outside ordinary settings, we need to sort of say, well, is that a good enough? And I'm sort of, that's why I think one needs this sort of balance between this personal and social model. So I would propose this two-dimensional model, and I would suggest that future monitoring in that diagram should really be focused much more on that. But I know that's hard. It's much easier to do a sort of a body count using these very large databases. I'm not sure about the value of that. So I hope I've stuck to my 15 minutes. And I'd be very happy if people wanted to have these slides.
Ron, thank you so much. Very thoughtful as well. Would you be happy just to rejoin the colleagues while Artemie comes to speak? And then would you be available to come and take questions at the end? And we'll look across all the presentations we've had so far. Thanks very much indeed. So Artemie is the founder of All Knowledge About CSIE. And I know you're going to sit for your presentation, so do you want me to move that for you?
It's okay.
Yeah, okay.
I could stand if that's easier. Yes.
Are you happy then? You said earlier you were more comfortable sitting.
I am.
You need to be comfortable.
Yeah. You don't want to watch me collapsing, do you?
Thanks very much. So, good timing. Like a fanfare announcing your arrival. Artemie, thanks very much. I know you're going to talk about the archive project, which is the reason for today, if you like, but also a bit about the history of the... was that this afternoon?
I'm picking up from where Bram left right now.
Okay, lovely. Thanks very much indeed. Thank you. And then we'll have questions across the morning before we go for lunch.
Yes. Sorry, if you're sitting, can the mic go higher? I'm challenged in my hearing.
Is this better? Oh, is this one?
It's fine when you're right next to the mic, but it goes...
Is this better now?
It's very, very direct.
When you turn or something like that.
So something like this?
That's good. That thank
okay.
you.
Excellent. I'll try to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, and much easier sitting down. So, can you put people behind me? I'm aware that you've all been sitting down for a rather long time, and please bear with me. I will try not to take too much of your time, but there are some things that I really want to say, and I think add flesh to the bones of what we've had so far. And then there will be an opportunity to have a discussion, ask some questions, hear some comments from you, so there will be an opportunity for you to engage. But for now, I will be very strict with myself, and I will not take more than 15 minutes. We've heard a lot about legislation, and I think I want to draw your attention to two separate issues about legislation. On the one hand, one of our speakers, I think Brown just now said about the 1981 Act that was based on this very report that I'm hearing, on the Warnock Report, and that was the founding rock of the beginning of inclusion as we know it today. This is my personal view, but I think we have inherited a system that started off on the wrong foot. I think when the 1981 Act came into place and suggested that all children should be educated in their ordinary mainstream school, as long as the number of provisions were met, I think it was poorly timed. It was 1981. If we go back 10 years, 1971, we still had the Education Act of 1944. We still had 11 categories of handicap, as they were called at the time. And we still had this notion that there are some children who are, if you please, ineducable. That was the term that was used. And up until 1971, there were these children who were deemed ineducable, who were looked after, they weren't really educated at all, but they were placed in these institutions that were called junior training centres, and they were just passing their time as nicely as possible. There wasn't anything really very constructive about them. So here comes the 1971 Act, and says that nobody is ineducable, and those children that were under the provision of the health authority as junior training centres were, now have to come under the education authority, education department. Now imagine, if you're a teacher working in schools, imagine how discombobulating that could be, that suddenly schools have to provide for children who until yesterday were deemed ineducable. I've read a wonderful narrative by Ken Jupp, who talks about this time, and he says that special schools, junior training centres, just renamed themselves as special schools. And that's what happened. Now, if 10 years on, another Act of Parliament says that everybody should go to their ordinary mainstream school, well, that's a huge leap in a very short amount of time. And in my mind, and I reiterate, this is my personal opinion, I think that this came at a time that people weren't ready for it. And that we, you know, the legislation has followed over time, that we've tweaked the provisos, we've tweaked how this is applied. But generally, the way that this is understood and appreciated is that, kind of, this is what the law says, and, you know, we'll do the best we can, as long as we can, and for who we can. And it doesn't really matter about everybody else. And that's, you know, kind of overgeneralizing. But that's the general thing, that there wasn't ever a law, and there wasn't ever any attempt to implement that law and have any kind of accountability of what's going on in schools and who's providing the adjustments and how these children are being, how their needs are being met in schools. So without wanting to take up all of my time to make one point, that's my general contention, that the 1981 Act came too soon and it has been going through time in all of its subsequent iterations, carrying this kind of perception that we mean this for most children, not really for everybody, don't we? And it's never written down and it's never acknowledged, but I think this is the kind of denominator upon which we have been trying to change our education system. There's a kind of set of, I don't want to say attitudes in the sense of someone's got the right attitude or the wrong attitude, but it's perception. It's how diversity is understood and what we expect, how we expect society to respond to it. And I want to make a second point about legislation and to flag up, and again, thank you to the previous speakers, both Bram and Sue, but actually and Robin, who have mentioned this. At the moment, the education of disabled children is governed by two separate acts, and we have the Children and Families Act, and without wanting to spend too long on this, I think I will perhaps put forward an overgeneralization that it's mostly founded on principles consistent with the medical model of disability. And we also have the Equality Act. You know, it places a duty on all schools. There's the reasonable adjustments duty, it's an anticipatory duty. There's the duty to, so the general somebody
public sector.
The public sector equality duty, thank you very much. Which is an anticipatory duty that schools have to take steps before anybody knocks on their door and saying, I live down the road. They have
one of the windows is slower than the others, so that's why it's a little bit protracted this time.
We're going to acknowledge the diversity and we shall let them.
Let the slower windows be slower and we'll wait for them.
So the anticipatory duty of making our schools ready to include disabled children, young people, when they come and say, I live in your catchment area, and disabled members of staff when they say, you know, I'd like to work in your school. And the two different aspects of legislation are very, very different in how they understand disability and what they expect to happen. And I think that's all I have time for saying. I'm very happy to pick this up as a question later on. But on the whole, Children and Families Act based on medical model of disability, Equality Act based on the social model of disability. And this brings me to a point that Bra mentioned just now about, and it comes up in any such discussion, it comes up of, you know, the question of where should children best be educated, and we've seen some of the reports that come up with quite interesting positions. And when we were working with Ram on this, and I will make sure that they all go on a table that you can look at them. This is the latest report that Ram mentioned that is also online with the interactive map with all of the local authorities listed from top to bottom. And in this report, from time to time, there are some quotes from people who work in local authorities, all very colour-coded, and I think they are... Yeah, quotes from local authorities are in blue background, so you can have a look at them. And I was the person ringing up the local authorities and asking them to make their comments. And what had really struck me for the first time, and it's about kind of 10 years since I was in post, but what really struck me was how committed everybody was to their perspective and how we had such polarized positions. I can't express this in a different way. Polarized positions, which were all founded upon people's perceptions of what's best for children. Everything is in the name of children's own good. And yet we still have such polarized positions that are not often easily... I think we just need to unpeel layer upon layer of meaning. And the way I understand it, and again, this is my personal opinion, I think that there is a very strong lobby of support for inclusion in ordinary schools for everybody. And that is founded on the suggestion that's what children's rights are. That's what the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child says, that's what the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities say, that's what the Standard Development Goal, Sustainable Development Goal number 4, says. The international pressure, the international movement is for more inclusive education, for including disabled children in their own middle school as much as possible, and it has been done elsewhere. If I have time, I will share with you an amazing story from what I've observed in Toronto, in Canada. So that's the one potentially polarized position. This is what we need to do because that's what the international legislation says, that's what we have to do, that's the direction of travel. And there's another very strong set of equally potentially polarized positions that say that children should be in separate special schools. That's where bespoke provision is. They can provide what is not available in mainstream schools, and that's where these children should be. And if you ask me, the first position is a position based on a perception of human rights. It's based on children's rights. That's where they need to be. And we make sure we change the system and we change the schools, we change the way that we organise teaching and learning to be able to make that happen. The second position is a reflection of what is readily available today. If we have parents who are choosing to walk to special schools with both feet because they don't feel that their children are served well enough in mainstream schools, that means that their children aren't served well enough in mainstream schools. That is a fact, that is true, it is sad, we need to change it. But that is what we need to change. So, to summarise, to conclude this point, I think that this really is a false dichotomy. One position is based on human rights values, the other on reflections of what is currently available. This would be a really good opportunity to move and let this point settle. They don't want to do that. That's okay. So respect their choice. 25 more minutes, is that right?
Yeah.
Thank you. I have a choice of one or two favourite stories to tell you. I'll try and fit both in 5 minutes. Okay. About 10, 15 years ago, I visited Toronto in Canada, the Hamilton Wentworth Catholic District School Board closed down all of its special schools in 1969, long before the rest of the world started going in that direction, had been educating everybody in ordinary schools since then. When parents move into the area and they have a meeting, say, what would you like for your child? And parents say, oh, no special school, please, that's the only thing that would be suitable. They say, let us show you what we have available. And if you still would like a special school, we can arrange for the child to go across the border to another school. And that's fine. You can have what you want. Let us show you. And they go to mainstream schools and they show how they have transformed how they organize their schools, how they have transformed, and they can provide a good education. They find ways. They have lots of support workers. They have support assistants, support learning supporters. They have a lot of technology to assist with a variety of needs. And they are able to respond to diversity in ways that are much more imaginative and much more constructive to what we are used to seeing in this country. And they said to me that invariably the parents who've moved in determined that what they really want is a special school. So if they can be in the same place as their peers and still learn, why would I want anything different for them? And we'll hear from Richard Reeser later on through another video presentation, but what I've learned from Richard early on is that he says that if people grow up at the margins of society, they go to a separate school away from their peers, their siblings, friends and potential friends in the local community, it is very hard, if not impossible, to get a foot back in after you've left school. And that's the kind of principle, that's the values, that's the human rights based argument that has powered CSA's work for 43 years. And the story I want to share, I won't have time to make my last point, but I will share this story with you. I went to visit...
Depends how quickly you tell the story, actually. Okay. I think you could probably make your final point as well.
Thank you. I attended an award ceremony, and they were, I can't remember how many schools, but it was a huge hall, densely crowded with parents, with young people who were receiving awards, and with their teachers and with their supporters and their helpers. And you just have to imagine a place 3 or 4 times more the size of this, with massive screens either side, honing in on individual children being given their award. And they were coming up 4 or 5 at a time. It was all very well planned. They had little carpet tiles on the floor, so everybody knew exactly where they were going to stand. And there was a minute film about each child, the young person who was receiving the award. And you could tell that some of them felt extremely uncomfortable with this level of attention. And they did all manner of things, and they twitched, and they fidgeted, and they forced them, and they did all sorts of things. And some had a supporter with them, and some were on their own. And all but one managed this. One young woman was really completely overwhelmed, and she fell to the floor, and she kicked, and she screamed, and words that I will not repeat here. She just completely was blown away by all the pressure. She could not rise to that challenge. And I couldn't resist to ask afterwards what kind of school had she attended. You may be able to guess that she had attended a special school. And I think this is the best thing that inclusion can give our children and young people, is learning to coexist with others. If we put them separately in a bubble with people like them or not so like them, as the case often is, young people don't have the experience to navigate the ordinariness of being with other non-disabled people. So I'm going to leave you with that story.
Yeah, your final point.
Thank you. My final point. Okay. It's kind of bringing together all of what I've said so far in one line of thought. I'm thinking back to a time, the point I'm trying to make is that this is all very much about our perspective, about our understanding, our perspective of disability, and how we allow the context to come into our thinking. So we've, you know, really the difference between the social and the model, or the medical model, is about understanding the role of the context. Yeah? Medical model says a person is disabled because of their impairment. Social model says they're disabled because they have an impairment, and society is organized as though everybody was not disabled. So taking account of the context. And I remember the time when, 30, 40 years ago, there was a lot of discrimination against disabled people. And I remember the time when people were chaining themselves to buses to get more accessible transport. People were saying that, you know, move to more accessible public toilets. And the response was kind of, what do you expect? You know, you're disabled, like, it's just hard luck kind of thing. That's not for you. That's not for people like you. And over time, public opinion has changed considerably. And some of the public institutions have changed enormously. In health, not far from here, the confidential inquiry into premature deaths of people with disabilities flagged up how many disabled people were losing their lives unnecessarily because the medical profession was not attending to their needs properly. We've moved forward since then. Of course, it's been a long way to go. But in education, I would contend that this hasn't happened yet. In education, there's still a very strong, prevailing feeling that that's where people like you go. That there are ordinary schools for some, and anybody who doesn't fit into them has to go somewhere else. And I would argue that that calls for a similar shift in our thinking of understanding that, yes, some people are different, but this is in the context, and this is the context is the breadth of human diversity. Some people are born with different minds, different bodies, some people become disabled later in life. But we're all of equal value by virtue of being human. And the idea that we treat all of our children the same, give them the same opportunities, so that they can have similar outcomes, to me is non-negotiable. Maybe I didn't make this point very carefully, very clearly, but I was trying to do it quickly. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. And it struck by another little bit of language that creeps into the system. I did a little analysis a few years ago of ministerial speeches and some of the headlines in the Times Educational Supplement. Anyone here used to take the Times Educational Supplement? Okay, good. There's a bit of experience there. What's really interesting is that throughout, we talk about stretch and challenge for our most able students and help and support for those, I quote, who struggle with learning. Boot on the other foot, if you like, teachers, schools who struggle to arrange learning in a way that makes it accessible. That was by way of a diversion, because I think that there is an underlying problem about language. And when we talk about support, very often that support, if not carefully thought through and well designed, can actually stand between the child, their teacher, their friends, and the curriculum. So we need to be aware of the fact that if you are going to be able to learn and make progress in a mainstream or not ordinary school, we need to be focused on the education that we're making available. And around that, the importance of the social interactions that are necessary to the learning process. So, that was really, actually, I was going to say, Sue and Bron, would you like to come up and sit
with Artemy, and we'll take a few questions across the different presentations from the morning. So, Artemy, keep the microphone with you.
I will bring
you
along there.
No, this chair's for... There we go. We've got three of you. I'm going to stand so I can see everyone. When you twitch to ask a question, I will spot you more easily if I'm standing up. So, yes, it's actually nothing to do with that. It's about so, colleagues, a lot to digest, and just on a practicality, Artemy. Is everyone going to make their slides, their talk, their film available for those who've been at the conference? Lovely, thanks Brahm very much.
Brahm
certainly
yes.
mentioned it. Sue,
I can definitely do that, yes.
Yours, yes. People need to read it to yes. have a bit of time to digest it as well. And Artemy, your talk as well, lovely. Thanks very much indeed. It's just that there's been a lot to digest. Quite a lot of challenge there, as well as quite a lot of information. So, would you like to, anyone bursting to ask a question? Linda, please. Thank you.
I've got thousands.
No, ask the top one, and then we'll see if there's time to come back for your second one.
I'm interested in why nobody talked about eugenics, because it's my firm belief that we are still living with the consequences of the eugenic movement that was given credibility and respectability in the late 19th and early 20th century. And even up until the 50s and 60s, we were still putting children into mental handicap institutions quite regularly because they were still considered to be part of those groups of people that Winston Churchill said in 1913, need to be weeded out of society in order to protect the purity of the race. I really believe that we are still colluding with those ideas by making this too complicated, by thinking that it's still okay for children to be educated separately from just, you know, why do we not think there should be units for all sorts of other children? Why is it okay to still think it's all right for us to have separate rooms, separate schools, separate places for children with particular labels and not others? When I started teaching, we were still putting black children in rooms if they were perceived as needing to have additional support for becoming part of
the
culture.
Can I just pause you? Can you hear at the back? Right.
Yeah, I was going to ask for the mic. And we were still putting children in rooms together who were not English speakers when they first came to school. Yeah. So I'm interested in why we're still saying it is okay from a human rights perspective when we're actually still colluding with a set of ideas and an ideology that led to the extermination of millions of disabled people and millions of Jewish people in the Nazi period.
Okay. Quite a lot of the question.
I have no answer.
Your starting point was why have we not referred to that this morning?
Exactly.
Let's just take that specific first.
I can give you a quick answer. I didn't mention it for lack of time. But I think my final point about needing to change attitudes and not just nod things through because we've always done that. Very much reflects your point, and I think the recent happenings in Parliament about the assistant dying or assisted living bill very much reflect that we're still in that kind of anachronistic way of thinking that are othering that aspect of diversity. And thank you for raising that.
Don't feel free to. It's a crucial point,
and I think the reason why I didn't grapple with it on one level is because I grapple with it every day on some levels, because as a lesbian, I'm acutely aware that you know, in the Holocaust, there were lesbians and gays in there. There were gypsies in there. There were Romanies in there. There were so many people who were othered. And for me, my passionate work, and I love that name of that website, Patience and Passion, my passion has been to challenge those prejudices and stereotypes. So it absolutely is underlined in all my work, but it's something which in you saying, what about eugenics, maybe that needs to be raised higher again. It's because it drives it, but I'm not naming it. So I would thank you for that, and I would think about how we weave it more highly in that process. So thank you.
Rom, did you want to add anything?
Well, I feel I need to justify why I didn't.
Just take Artemis' approach. You didn't have time.
No, it's more than that.
Yes.
I would say it's principled why I didn't. Well, I mean, there's obviously pragmatic, because I was asked to speak in 15 minutes. It is a background issue, of course, but I think one's got to be careful about eugenics and eugenics in terms of abortion and what... question. Basically, we're talking about a conflict of rights, and that's the issue. It's a very big issue in rights theory. Are there conflicts of rights, or can you reinterpret them away? And that has enormous practical significance, and I personally don't think you can. And I think the reason why I spoke not negatively but positively, because I think behind this is you're trying to connect eugenics with having separate units, because we don't have imposed national final solutions anymore at the moment. That's what the extermination of the Jews was about. It was a final solution to the Jewish problem. It was imposed. Apartheid in South Africa was imposed on all people who were non-white. So I think we don't have that. We have a lot of choice built into our legislation. Now, you might argue that the choice is badly implemented. It is badly implemented. But the principle is there. And therefore, when the study I reported, the parents did feel they chose those special schools. They felt it was a hard choice. I didn't give you the data. They thought they had a dilemma. They really felt they had a dilemma. They didn't. But those who really wanted the special school, nothing but a special school, did not experience a dilemma. But a good proportion of them had a real experience of a dilemma. And why do you experience a dilemma? Because there's a tension of values. There's a balance of rights. How do I satisfy my needs of my child in terms of one element as well as in another element? And I guess, in a sense, that's why I didn't. So I guess I resist the idea of putting eugenics as... because eugenics is really a national imposition, not just through law, but through force, through putting people on trains and sending them to extermination camps. So I think there's quite a big difference.
Oh, we've got lots of questions.
Thanks very much, and thanks for your responses to that. Now, this may be in response. Can I just check? Does anyone want to come in on this point? Yes. Okay. So we will make sure there's time for other points as well. But just to keep this point, would you like to just say who you are, would you please?
My name's Adele, and I'm a co-carer of a disabled young person.
Thank you.
And. I don't believe there is a choice, actually. I don't think it's, from our perspective, my son's got three rare genetic progressive conditions. He is a special school kid, and the overwhelming drive to have him in special school, it's made me ill battling that all the way. Even when he's in mainstream school, he's 18 now, the whole drive to keeping him separate was overwhelming. Yep. And I couldn't really meddle too much. I was they kept me there, I had arguments with. So is there really a choice? I'm not sure there is a choice.
It seems
because parents come in today, they choose special school to keep the children safe. Shouldn't have to keep the children safe in ordinary society.
Yeah. Thank you very much for adding that point into that, actually, is there a choice? And I think, And you wanted to come in on the same issue, I think.
Similar. I mean, I've got a couple of things to say. I was Miles Williams. I was a professor in disability studies here. And, I really appreciate what you said just now. I think the more voices we can have from practical experience. So So, yeah, trying to frame this as a question is difficult.
Don't bother.
Does anyone know?
Just say what you want to say.
So, two things, really. One is about the past, one is about the future. So, the thing about the past, it relates to law, actually. That's my best way of framing it as a question. Because, Artemy, you said something about the 1981 Act didn't work. And the 1981 Act, and I was teaching here in Bristol at the time when that came in, was very aspirational. It was about abstracts. It was about moving people towards inclusion. However, the previous 1971 Act was much more about this is illegal if we do it this way. And actually, it really did work. I was employed actually in 1975 by a special school to help with children who were still being educated under social services provision here in Bristol, at a place that doesn't even exist anymore. And we used the 1971 Act, my friend Sally Silverman and myself, to actually close that down and to move those children, okay, into a special school, but nevertheless they would then move within education, and that did of course have an effect on how their education proceeded. So there are different kinds of laws is what I'm going to say first, and I don't know whether that, you know, whether that, okay, friend, this is a question. Toronto, that's interesting. That's really interesting because you can see that the law there is no special schools. So if you close everything, then it forces the point. I mean, did you explore the law, Artemy?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, but also I explored the practice. I was really intrigued to see how it's done, and that's what's the difficulty here. I think it's very hard sometimes to imagine things done differently, and that's why I like to share this experience to remind people, yes, it has been done, yes, it is possible.
And I think the issue is that in effect it has become a moral choice on the part of senior leaders of schools, because in a sense there are no accountabilities for not being committed to include children in the local area, ensure they get a good education along with their peers. And I think that's one of the reasons for the disappearance of the choice. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. I don't want to dominate, so I'll come back later perhaps.
Yes,
but when you move that on to social practices, and as you know, that's something we could discuss a little bit more.
Thank you. Let's hope we have time more. We have two more minutes. Shall we try and take...
Yes, I was going to go, you put your hand up right at the beginning, and do please tell us who you are and ask your question.
I'm Emily, I'm an organiser for the National Education Union, and I did my master's kind of around this topic. My main sense from working with educators and parents and just generally talking to people I know is that no one believes that it's feasible to have full inclusion. And yet there are examples now, so we're in a better place now to be able to convince people that it is feasible, because there are examples where it's completely worked, or nearly completely worked, as in Newham. And I think, how are those examples getting out there? Are they getting out there at all? It's crazy to me that no one I ever speak to has heard of the inclusion policy in Newham. In London, and is there a role here for organising educators? Are educators the people to convince? Is there a role for organising the community by sharing this information and through community organising? Mm-hmm. Who do you think, like, why is that not happening?
Linked to that, Brahm's point about the lack of research in this area. Actually, what enables it to work? And just while I know, Linda, you want to come in, and panelists are going to respond to your point in a minute, but I just point out to what we know that Warnock recommended is that the 81 Act was made in the wake of Warnock, but it only put into statute the things that you can really legislate about. All the other things, like this curriculum, she said very clearly in her book, curriculum needs to change. She said teacher training needs to change. Mm-hmm. She said the local specialist support services need to be readily available to schools to help and support when they're not clear how to proceed. So all those things that didn't happen, yet we've gone ahead and we've legislated multiple times without really making that a sport of whale. But Brahms' point about the research is that that then doesn't get any daylight shed on it, does it? So please respond to the point.
I want to let Linda speak to respond on behalf of Newham, if that's what you want to do. But I also want to flag up that Warnock also said something very close to, without the wholehearted commitment of teachers and schools, the best planning is not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And we haven't had the wholehearted commitment yet.
Just to point out, Brahms' quote of Warnock from 2005, not 1978.
Yes.
And for me, one of the things that is crucial is teacher training. And thank you for being NEU. I've been in NEU for over 50 years. And the NEU has done amazing things is to get LGBT teachers together, to get disabled teachers together, and to actually enable the people who are grassroots workers to think about these issues. And I think Unison might be doing the same thing. NAHT should be doing. I think unions can be a very powerful way of, from the grassroots, pushing up. Because if we don't have the grassroots teachers passionate about making the change, we're wasting our time. So it's enabling our teachers, and the unions will play an incredibly important area in that. Dr. David Braniff Herbert, who's done all the work about enabling LGBT teachers, we have 350 LGBT teachers working together every year. Now, the same thing needs to be done around race, around class, around disability. Get the teachers to be passionate. Get the teachers to want to change it and to do the pushing. So unions have a really big job in doing that.
Sorry, one more point from me, if I may. You asked what can we do. We've put on this event, we've had about 50 people book to capacity, and not everybody's here. So I ask the same question, what more can we do?
Linda, you wanted just to talk about Newham for a minute.
I think we will need
the last thing before lunch.
Yeah. I have got a slot later, but in answer to Emily's question, Emily researched in Newham, which is how she knows about it. And we did in Newham reach the same point that Toronto reached. At one point we had 30 children in special school, and almost every school was inclusive. Some were not quite as good as they should be, but we had a completely whole community approach. And quite honestly, it scared people. I was on platforms with people from the Department for Education through those years when I was being asked to speak in every local authority in the country, and abroad I worked with the Spanish government a few years ago to support them to develop their national policy. I worked with the Portuguese government, but our government were terrified, because I think if we had a fully inclusive system, it would be a major challenge to the establishment. Having the exclusion of children with disabilities still enables us to have that, you know, and I come back to the eugenic ideology that some people are better than others, some people deserve more than others, and it really frightened particularly Michael Gove. I mean, it started with the Labour government, and I think, you know, Brahms' point that this started to go downwards before austerity is really important, because Andrew Adonis was the beginning of the downward spiral that we've hit the rock bottom with. When they started to think about academisation, they were terrified that our education system was producing such good results, because through the years that we had a more inclusive system, we had the biggest improvement in attainment, and since then it's plateaued.
Linda, thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you there, because you've got fear. Okay. It's because it's a challenge to the establishment. It's a challenge to the rich and powerful. So everything that we did in Newham should have, and it did, lots of other authorities did do lots as well at that time. Calderdale had an inclusion, Nottinghamshire, lots of others. But it created fear in the establishment, and it's why we went back to the narrowing of the curriculum, etc.
So it's
Linda,
it's very
thank
good
you. And I know you're going to pick up a lot of those themes this afternoon. So thanks very much indeed.
Shall I talk about the lunch arrangements?
Yes. Now, Artemy is going to walk you through the lunch arrangements. There's some very specific requirements around it all.
Thank you. So I'm going to demonstrate exactly what we're saying in schools, that equality doesn't mean treating everybody the same, but equality means that if we all want you to enjoy lunch, then some people are going to have different treatment. So I invite those who are vegetarians, please, to go to the front of the queue to make sure that there is a vegetarian option for you. The government should be here to listen, shouldn't they? See how many choices. Please go to the front of the queue if you're a vegetarian. Somebody has requested a gluten-free lunch. Please respect that and leave it to the person who has requested it. And we reconvene at 1:30. And in the meantime, I invite you to explore and just enjoy the various displays that we put out for you. And I really have to flag up that in this booth here, there are some old CSA resources and some leaflets that you are very welcome to take away with you. They're a little gift for you from CSA today. Other displays are part of our archive, and please, therefore, display only, please do not take away. So there are index translations out there. I'm going to put all the different versions of the trends research that Frank spoke about over here. There is an opportunity for you to explore and buy if you want to, sort of making it happen. And please do enjoy, you know, come read the poster, enjoy the map of where CSA has had connections with. Above all, enjoy your lunch. Thank you for your attention. Please let for those who are
the part of the instruction about where to go.
Please remember to keep quiet before, you know, respect people who are working nearby. Thank you.
After that, special, I think it's special school.